Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Happy spring. Lots and lots of bird action out of my house lately, so I've been really enjoying that. Even though earlier on I sort of wanted to be saying, are you sure, you know, are you sure about this? Is this okay? But they're there. So, as we have entered our practice period and have been starting to kind of delve into teachings of Zen Master Lin Ji, who was born in China in around 810, into a time of tremendous amount of turmoil in China, the Tang Dynasty, when there were waves of persecution, and particularly one really, really intense year of persecution of Buddhists, but lots of turmoil in general in that time. I want to talk a little bit about Lin Ji, but mostly I want to talk about kind of the experience of living my way into, living our way into some of what he does and says. He, as a young man, he became a monk pretty early on and did a lot of studying. He did the classical course of study of sutras and commentaries and the Vinaya, the precepts. And he came to a point where he just kind of exhausted his own belief in all of it, in all of that teaching, in all of that sort of codified teaching as an avenue to freedom. And so it wasn't that he had all of that under his belt. And it wasn't, he never said that was a bad thing. But he came to a place where he just felt as if that relying on that to for a deep awakening, for freedom, for a life of responsiveness, didn't feel right to him. It didn't feel like he was getting there. That the transformative power of it was damped down by our tendency to make doctrine, our human tendency to make ourselves a structure and lock ourselves in and throw away the key, you know. And so he set about to find what else then, you know, if this is not, if this doesn't have power for me for the way, then what? And so those concepts were tired, you know, and just the way we find now in our time that certain language that has a kind of inherent power gets tired, you know. So sometimes, for example, the word compassion, sometimes you hear, you know, compassion, 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 until it doesn't touch your heart anymore. It doesn't wake something for you anymore, because it's sort of lost its keen edge, you know. It's gotten dull. And so the concepts were tired, and the concept of a master, a teacher, was tired. And so he wanted to just find a way to shed the crud that had accumulated around the ways that we talk about what's real and what's essential and what matters. And so he preferred, instead of talking about teacher, even to talk about the way it is when we meet truly eye to eye and heart to heart with a spiritual friend. What can be alive there that's not held in the books, that's not held in the scrolls and the scriptures and even in ourselves when we've memorized all that stuff? What's the aliveness that we can offer to each other that allows what is most fundamentally real to just appear and for us to be responsive to it? And so that was his project. And so I was thinking about that, the dynamic of realizing, of letting something be, letting some fundamental experience of what's most true, what's most real, letting it be real, embodied by us. Yeah, coming forth as us. What is it like when it comes forth as Jay, when it comes forth as Jackie, you know? Then what's it like? What is it? How does that help us carry this understanding forward in our lives in a way that matters, that helps somebody? The tired concept. So I was thinking about the discussions that I see online and in other places about how language is being abused and how there's no respect for truth, and thinking about truth and lies and you know, looking at Donald Trump's use of words, for example, you know, the greatest, the biggest, huge, and him at the CIA when he went to make that first appearance and he was talking about how much he loved and respected everybody. And wasn't that right? And I can't remember what words he used, but it was like, I love you all. I think you're the greatest, right? And meanwhile, he's trashing what they're doing, you know, and so we have this mistrust for the words that we're using. A deep mistrust for the words that we're using. And that can be kind of a cool thing. You know, because then we have to go, well, what is that exactly? What is it when it's real? What is it when it's alive? Yeah? And what words can we use to say what is alive? And so it's not just Donald Trump, right? It's all of us that slip into habits of using words conventionally, right? In ways that, where we're not actually thinking about what's the internal raw truth of this? Yeah? And sometimes the words just don't make it. They're not going to get to the raw truth. Yeah? Because they can't, because the word can't get there. And all along, we've been agreeing that we'll use words to try to point, right? And that the Buddha said that's what he was doing. Linji says that's what he's doing. He talks about, where is that exact phrase? That he writes, he's writing words in the sky, in the air. Yeah? Words that are gone as soon as they're, you know, before they're even written. You know, that kind of language. Yeah, like the track of a bird in the sky. That kind of path, creating with words that kind of path. So we all do that, and we all could use a little cutting through. So then Linji starts to try to use some language differently, and to not use language sometimes. And so when you read hear the koans in which there's a fair bit of whacking and shouting, it's easy to sort of dismiss that as culturally bound or as unduly violent and male and whatever. And that may be in there, but it's possible to look at what he's doing without getting stuck on our judgment like of that, which is not to say those might not be factors, but if you look at what he's doing and what he says he's doing, it's a thing that's not so easy to do. How do we present what's real with each other? How do we learn to respond before the words come, before we figure out what to say? And how do we touch each other intimately? Yeah? And so this was a way that they were trying to do that very important thing. And they were so keenly aware of how important it was that they would agree with each other to try this kind of methodology. Yeah? What if we just give, what if I just come forth with, I don't know when I, before I do that, what it's going to sound like, you know? And I have to be ready to come forth with something not knowing at all what it's going to sound like. Try it. You'll discover. Until you hear it, you don't know what your own shout is going to sound like. It's an experiment. Yeah? So different. And when you, if you're a dancer, when you start to dance, you don't know. And I think a lot of dancers will tell you, you tell me if this is true, that if you dance in front of a mirror, you're going to kill your dance because you're going to be looking at what you look like, which is not where it's at, right? So this is like that, the dance that you do when you're not looking in the mirror, yeah? Okay, so Linji starts to talk about the person with nothing to do and nowhere to go. The person with nothing to do and nowhere to go. The non-business person. Or the businessless person. And so I wanted to explore a little bit sort of my own experience of this sense of unraveling of and noticing the texture of the weave of the business person in me, the person who's all business. And what about the person who's not business at all? Where is she? What is she? What comes forth? Okay? So we kind of know our business person, right? You know, you got a list. You know, whether you're a list-making person or not, you've got a list, right? And so we direct ourselves a lot, yeah? And so I was thinking about so many ways that we do that and that we do it within our Buddhist practice, right? This is the path I'm on. The minute we say, I am a Buddhist, that's a list right there. You know, so what is it like to be on the awakening path? Suppose that's something, but not focused on the business of attaining enlightenment. To be on the path, but not focused on the business of getting enlightenment, even for other people, right? But rather that just here, because I'm here, because I happen to be alive, because we are here, we can help each other. And we find a kind of confidence. We have experience, we are experiencing a kind of confidence in this way of going, in this path, in this way of moment by moment awakening. We think that there is a kind of home here, there's a kind of that we can have confidence in our very being here willing to be helpful to each other. And so it's so easy to get stuck in my sense of what my job is. You know, there was one time in particular, deep in a retreat, when I, working on a particular koan, I suddenly realized with this tremendous surge of emotion, of relief and laughter and tears, that I thought my job was to get the world under control. You know, that my job was to kind of take care of everything. And like, how, good luck with that. You're little bitty Sarah, you know, whose job is to make it all turn out right somehow. And it was just suddenly seeing that I thought that was my job, you know, and then I could quit. I quit. I'm no longer going to be responsible for the world turning out right. I mean, that's quite a list, right? That was my business. You know, that was, in some sense, what I thought was my business. Yeah? And so, I'm sorry about that, because you've all experienced the consequences of that.
Good thing.
And so, suppose we think our job is to follow the teachings of the Buddha, right? It's so easy for that to become the brass ring, right? It's my job to follow. We can so quickly make a thing of that, make a business of it, right? Subtly. Or to find my true purpose, which is one that always has bugged me, so I probably ought to look at it. But it's like, really? I'm alive. You know? If I think that there is some true purpose out there, and that my business is to find it, I have made a thing out of true purpose. Right? It's not going to help me very much. Or to succeed, whatever that is. Or to become the best person that I can. Can you see the trap in that one? How that's a business? That there is some best person, and my job is to become that best person? Help me. Or to know myself. My job is to really know myself. Yeah? One person got his leg broken trying to get in the door to a teacher who told him that was a lost cause. Wasted effort. Because again, you're making a thing out of your true self, right? I'm going to find out who I really am, and then other people better see it. Which is usually the corollary, right? I'll find out who I really am, and hopefully everybody will be able to see me for who I really am. Mm. Or to heal. Or to have a great relationship. Or to be happy. If I think my job is to be happy. Well, there's self-obsession for you. Right there, yeah? Or to be enlightened. So what if my sense of having a job, my job in life is, whatever it is, what if that is really the ultimate distraction? What if that's the ultimate distraction that moment by moment will just pull me away from what's right in front of me, right under my very nose? Yeah? It's a very available addiction. That sense of having business to do. And so, what about when we stop? What about those moments which you've already had zillions of in your life when you don't have a job? Yeah. When you don't have a business, when you're not about something. I just had a funny connection happen, which was that story about Jesus when you know, he was 12 or something, and his parents were looking for him, and they couldn't find him, and they finally found him in the temple. And they're like, you know, what are you doing here? And didn't he say something like, I was about my father's business? But that was the business of no business, right? He was hanging out because that was where he wanted to be. You know, that's not business, non-business. Yeah. And if I have that story right, which I might not. Anyway, that's my story about it. So when I find I'm no longer that business person, and so this was really what a lot of what I think Linji was about, and what he wrote, talked about. He didn't write about it. People wrote down what he said much later. Talked about that actually all the time, all the time, there is the true person of no rank, no job. The true jobless person is coming and going through the gates of your face. Constantly, it's a constant, yeah? A constant presence coming and going through the gates of your face. And if you don't have to make any sense of that, but you can just feel your way into it, it's pretty interesting because you don't have to make a thing about it, right? You don't have to make a thing out of it. The coming and going constantly through the gates of your face. And so that true person, one thing that I find so beautiful about, so liberating about that teaching is that he's not abstracting. He's not actually saying something that's a concept. He's not laying down another belief. And he's not making an abstraction out of it. He's saying, person, you're a true person, right? This true person. Constantly. Present and freely coming and going, yeah, through you, and in and out, and so then maybe a little hesitantly at first, when I'm feeling that, I can notice that just being me is pretty amazing, actually. When I take away anything that has to be done about it, right? That just actually getting to be me in this life, just as it is, and believe me, it's just as messed up as anybody's, this life, and just as beautiful as anybody's, how completely amazing and inconceivably complex and intricate and unpredictable and full of beauty it is to be me. And that, could that somehow be enough? Could it be more than enough? And could it be that bubbling forth, that sort of, it feels sort of like a vibration or a buzz sometimes, the feel of it, just there's the aliveness of it, that because that true person is not contained within my skin, right? And yet it's not any place, is not here in my skin either. And so then to this person is available everything. Everything's available, right? And so when there is no hindrance, when there is no blockage, which there never is, there never really is any blockage, right? Then in some way it's acceptable. And that's the thing that so often is an obstacle, right? Will what I do somehow be acceptable? Will it be good enough? Will it be? And those then can become so quickly blockages unless we can allow ourselves to so much feel the freedom of just being me right here on this earth that we have it to give. We can be willing to give up that worry about, is this acceptable? Is this good enough? Will this do the trick? Because that's the list again, right? That's the business. But without the business, I can simply offer, right? I can simply offer a response. So, we don't know, right? We don't know what'll come out. We don't know what'll come in. Hallelujah. So then, the Buddhist teachings then, in this way of approaching them, of holding them, that Linji is, I think, offering us, the Buddhist teachings are teachers, right? Are teachers rather than teachings that we have to codify. It's not the business of awakening. Awakening is not a business. It's just what bees, it's what is, yeah? It's what we're free for. And then our friends are teachers. Each meeting is fresh. Never before. This, what we're doing right now, never before, never again. Never again, we're here. It's just this, that we get, we're being for each other. Each of us, yeah? Together in this room, being here for each other. It's a little embarrassing how wonderful that is, huh? We wouldn't want to talk about it. But here it is. And so then, what about, I want to talk just a little bit about inside and outside. Because as he teaches, Linji talks about turning the light inward. And we have our Hakuin also saying, if you turn the light inward, yeah, and witness your own nature, your nature, which is not a nature exactly, which is the true person, that true person, then what is that, turn the light inward? And I wanted to talk about that because I think there's an illusion that can interrupt us in this turning the light inward. And that's the illusion that it's about looking at all my thoughts and emotions as things and thinking they are me. You know, if I turn the light inward and recognize all of my karma and all of my quirks and all of my what I've done and what I will do and, you know, what I haven't done and won't do, and, you know, what people think I am and what I think I am, and, you know, blah, 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 blah. You know, that can become a kind of a swamp, you know, a swamp of boring stuff. And it's not that we don't want to see, you know, what we're doing. That's essential. But I don't think that's what Linji's talking about or Hakuin when they say, turn the light inward. I think what they're saying is, turn the light inward and light is looking right back at you. Right? Turn the light inward and what you find is light. Is light. A light that is also the dark. Yeah? And so and so then if you're witnessing that, It's in you, in your body. It's also, your body is not a barrier to it at all, right? Your body is it, but it is not confined in the meat of your body. It freely in and out all the time. And so this looking inward is just as much looking outward. You know, it's the flip. It's the flip that happens, right? And people who know physics will tell you about this, but there's a, you find that inside, suddenly everywhere, right? It's talking to you in the, you know, that wakes me up every morning. Where is that? Right? I'm going to call that out there. That's not how it feels when it wakes me up. So this outside, watch out for that. It's not, and so this inside is not, you know, my liver, and it's also not, it's not my opinions. Yeah? And it's not them. It's not excluding anything. Right? But it's not defining inside in that way. Yeah? And this outside, you know, when we define it, quite often I think we define as outside everything that is not here. Everything that's not me. Right? Not me is outside. And it's too easy to say it's not this, right? That outside is everything that's not my actual experience. That's kind of a weird thing to do, isn't it? That's kind of a setting up of a wall, which we don't have to do. So then if we don't do that, there's just all of this. There is just all of this amazing, live, buzzing this. Yeah. And so at that point, you know, that's why even to say I'm a Buddhist, if I say I am a Buddhist, I have stuck something out there, right? And already I've said it's not me because it's a Buddhist. You get how that little trick works? So I'm already saying I am not me. That's a little weird. So not to set up walls in the mind. Yeah. So then fortunately then we find in these Buddhist teachings that our teachers, good friends. And I think that's what all of those teachings were for in the first place, right? To be teachers, to be good friends. And we find in each other good friends who will be it in front of us to mirror. This is, look. This beautiful, this is also this beautiful, that this beautiful, this beautiful. Here it is. Yeah. And so good friends, what do? They recognize you, don't they? Your good friends in some way recognize you. Yeah. Recognize you. They recognize your complete fundamental all rightness. Yeah. The fundamental goodness that is you, they see it. Yeah. And your good friends have room. They create a feeling of spaciousness, don't they? When you're with your good friends, there's a feeling of enough space to be. Yeah. And they're beautiful. Yeah. And to me, the always the sort of taproot of what's real is it beautiful? Whatever it is, even if it's, you know, even if it's the stuff that's horrifying right now, do I find underneath that, that this too is this beautiful life? These throes, these agonies of change that we are going through, they also are this beautiful life. The long arc of which is learning how to be human, how to be beings. That too is beautiful. And good friends are a bit dangerous, right? They're a little exciting, a little unpredictable. Every so often they whap you upside the head. or they disappear when you thought you needed them, or they say that thing that you might need to hear but you don't want to hear. So they're challenging. A really good spiritual friend is challenging, yeah? And we ask for that, and since we know we ask for that, we can also offer that. We can risk that from our place of caring about our common awakening, which is the only awakening we have. So, if in order not to fall into making walls around us constantly, which we have a tendency, a sort of a habitual tendency to do, if what we need is to be off balance a little bit, then as we go on spending time with Linji, I'd like you to sort of notice whether that isn't a way of practicing coming forth with generosity, of practicing not being stingy about our own responses. Yeah? So when we are a little bit off, or more than a little bit off balance, that is when we get to practice coming, that be fully embodying that true person, that true you, that can come and go freely. Yeah? Responding to circumstances. That will let you see where you're tilting or putting something outside or believing some other story is better. Some other you would be better. Some other me would be better. How many times a day do you have that thought? I confess. Frequently. So this means you can learn to move freely. And I thought I was going to be shorter tonight, and I'm not. I want to give you one for instance of my own learning this way. On Wednesday night, I went down and made phone calls for Richard Scorman. So, you know, they've got some offices, and I had my little computer, and I was like, am I really giving my evening to this? You know, am I really going to go make a phone call? And so, anyway, I got there, and lucky for me, there was a high desk in the back room. It was quiet back there. So I put my little computer up on the high desk so I could be standing up and moving around. And I thought, okay, nobody's watching, you know. I can dance, you know. I can do whatever I want back here. And so, you know, I got maybe five people who answered in an hour and a half, and the rest of them were answering machines. So I thought, okay, if I get one of these messages, I'm pretty likely going to delete it before I even listen to it. But I don't know whether somebody's going to listen to this or not. And the computer's going to tell me it's a woman of, you know, 65, and she's unaffiliated, or she's a Democrat, or whatever. And so I can play. I can talk to her. And so I did. And so for an hour and a half, I just played at talking to whoever it was, saying the thing that I was really wanted to say, and dancing around. When I got the people who answered, it was really kind of fun. One of them just said, oh, nope, sorry, I already going the other way. And then, but there were these two wonderful old ladies who said, oh yeah, I remember Richard. You remember when, after Katrina, remember what he did for the people after Katrina? You know, and so there was, every once in a while there was a person, but what my point is that I felt so free. I felt so free to do it. You know, and it was it was a privileged moment because it wasn't that I thought I was accomplishing anything. It didn't seem very likely that I was accomplishing very much. But why not? Why not do it? I guess was the way it felt. Does that make any sense? And it felt like me. I felt like I'm not going to sit here and be doing business. That's not what I'm about. And I'm not going to think who I have to be to do this. I'm just going to be me and do it, you know? And then the next day, I went down to stand on the street outside of Senator Gardner's office and hold up a sign about healthcare. And, you know, I could just choose to feel like a complete idiot. And, you know, there was a little bit of that. But mostly, again, I thought, this is what I'm doing. You know, I'm out here. I got something to represent in a way. And Cindy was there, luckily. And again, I could move. So I walked back and forth and I held up my sign. And I just felt like this wonder of all these people coming and going. And it's kind of amazing. Here we are in a city doing this odd kind of communication with each other. One person gave me the finger, which just made me laugh. I was surprised by. I was like, God, he actually gave me the finger. But most people just either drove by and were trying to read the signs. One person finally walked by that I knew, and she said, you know, the people across the street can't actually read you guys' signs. So I rewrote my sign with bigger letters and went out there again. But there was just a feeling of that it wasn't business. Yeah? It wasn't doing business. It wasn't on my list. It was, huh, you know, here I find myself on the street. You know? Doing this, and here are people driving by, and I have no idea who's touching whom or what happens here. But it felt very free. So Linji says, be host wherever you are and use that place as your seat of awakening. And I just have the feeling that's not very hard to do. You know, we get to do that with each other. And we get to knock each other off balance and find out what comes forth. And it's okay because we can trust the fundamental goodness of each of us. We can trust that true person of no rank. That true person of no rank is very trustworthy. And this is how we save all beings. We let each place be a place of arrival so that we can trust that this, he says, this bright clarity, yeah, without the slightest outer form, knows how to meet the Dharma, knows how to meet the Dharma on the bare ground of this moment with no agenda, just to meet it. Yeah, that's where it will meet us. Where it does meet us. So thank you. And I'm sorry I was long again. We have time for a few comments, right? A little bit.
Yeah, about 5 to 7 minutes.
Okay, thank you. All right, so say what comes up for you.
I think you missed one thing when we were standing on the corner. Is we had a lot of people honk horns.
Yeah.
And give us the thumbs up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So there was communication going on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so we were, in a way, giving people an opportunity to express their own, to come forth themselves from their cars. Yeah.
Yeah, and a couple people yelled out the window, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt kind of, I'm used to being with a big crowd, and I felt, what's that word? Vulnerable?
Mm-hmm.
And that made me feel less so. Mm-hmm. Like, wouldn't be doing that.
Mm-hmm. Frank, I wanted to say something.
I was coming forth.
Ah, coming forth. Yeah. 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 I think that's why it made me laugh when that guy did that. You know, it's like, okay, he's saying where he is, you know. He's express yourself, brother.
Yeah.
I'd like to thank you for bringing up barriers. It just touched me to reconsider what I consider barriers.
You want to say more about that?
Well, just like this or this or thinking of a barrier. Even if it was real, it still could be seen in a different light. Mm-hmm. And of coming for you, even if it's something that's real, a physical constraint.
Mm-hmm.
Or...
Well, that's just the universe coming forth to meet you, right?
Yeah.
That's the thing that's meeting you right now. So the barrierness of it is a concept.
It made me smile.
It made you smile?
Me smile.
The barrier?
Yeah.
Yeah. Anything else? Nobody wants to tell me I'm full of shit? What's the problem? Thank you. It's true. It's so true. So what? And what else comes up?
I was on vacation for a couple of weeks, and it just made me think of what one of the. I work in a correctional facility, and it made me think of what one of the offenders said to me when I came back. Because usually I'm very much, you know, list. Very much.
Mm-hmm.
Very focused on my job, and I go to certain places at a certain time, and I'm just very regimented all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Since I came back from vacation, I'm just chilling. I've just been so relaxed. And one of my offenders said, "Miss, you were a real bitch before you went on vacation. Now you're so relaxed. You should have gone on vacation a long time ago."
And you're like, amen to that.
Nail right on the head.
That could be another way of saying someone with nothing to do.
Yeah.
Person on vacation.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I live by myself, so I spent a lot of time just not doing anything.
But what your offender noticed was that you were still, even while you had to be here now and here and here, and you had to do this and this and this, you still were that person.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And he could see it.
Mm-hmm.
And acknowledge it. Yeah. Yeah, because it's not about having to be on vacation all the time in that sense. Yeah, yeah. But a vacation helps. And your meditation helps. And that's the other thing is that Linji says over and over, yeah, that you're putting yourself on the cushion so that you can fall into the openness of this moment is really, really important.
How do we possibly hold space for the non-business minds when we live in a world that has so thoroughly institutionalized and privileged capital?
Mm-hmm.
How do we possibly do, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. That's the practice.
I am personally trying to create a less unjust food system,
mm-hmm.
and I'm constantly being met up with realities of a few things. One of which is how much that necessitates a lot of list-related work.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
A lot of what?
List-related work.
List-related.
And then the other thing, when I look at the nonprofit world, is how collusive it is with some of the structures that are causing injustices for which the nonprofits must exist.
Mm-hmm.
And how fascinatingly disturbing that is when you go deeper down that wormhole.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this is a bit meandering. I guess just that's just sort of what I'm facing right now is like, I think that a group of my friends and myself love holding space for what we call, in what I refer to as folk political actions, like, you know, like building a bikeable dinner table and creating a backyard farm and fun things like this. And then I think that we're often, and those are not business things. That's just like, we are just doing this, and it is, and that, and the gate is open in the face when that happens. But then we're, I find us often being met with these cold realities of like, these are just these little flurries in the midst of a universally extractive force. And just struggling with that. And I struggle with that a lot. And I struggle with that a lot.
And I think I'll try to stick with 2 minutes.
Okay.
So I think that there are a couple things about that that I'm really glad you brought that up, because in your own, that's such a vivid example of in your own life. And I know that each person in the room has some some similar struggles, especially right now where we're being asked to respond to extraordinary circumstances that we didn't plan for. And so the how to be a person with a list and with nothing to do is one thing. And that's where I think if we know that that's, that we could do that, we can get curious about what that's like. What is it like to be a person with my list and with, and a person with nothing to do? How does it, what is it like to be in business, because a nonprofit is business, without being a business person? And that's the question you're asking. And I think holding that question, living that question, is freeing. And if we're not focused on accomplishing the goal or the end point, if our activity is the non-activity of freeing ourselves within this, then can we trust that? That now this is what I'm doing. Now this is right to do. This particular kind of non-doing, including both the wonderful inventions and the, okay, now this is what I have to do in order for us to be able to continue to do this in this system, and what are the, and to get, how do we get smart about the subversive, what subverts in the very best sense, What are our actions that subvert the forces that are, that would close in around life? Does that help at all?
Yeah, it does.
It's not to answer the questions,
no,
say, yes, indeed.
Yes, indeed.
And our freedom then has to be within that, rather than seeing it as wrong.
Right.
What if it's not wrong? Thank you all so much for speaking up. Well, 3 minutes. Wasn't that bad.